All right, so that we know who we're talking about up here, we're going to do a little introduction going right on down the line here. Kevin Jablonski is my name, but I was the guy here earlier.
You might have recognized
me. Just a moment ago.
Yeah. So. I was just here as well. I was giving away a bunch of stuff. Steve Turnage, I got a record label. I do mastering. I had a music distribution system called WeedShare. I'm pretty involved with the current state of things. I keep up on it. Social networking situations. And it should be entertaining.
Jeff Lizowitz, and like I said before, I record under the name Electron Love Theory. It's electronic-based music for the most part. I've got a catalog of about 150 songs, which are used in film and TV placements. And I recently just got some record deals for my U2 electronic tribute album with 14 female vocalists, local female vocalists.
Rob, could you get the door?
Sure. My name is Mike Metesky. I'm an intellectual property attorney with the law firm Clark Wrist Sparkman. We're based in Portland. We have a Seattle office here.
Charles Hopper, producer-engineer out of Lennon Bridge Studios. I'm also a voting member for NERIS. I produce for local artists around the area. I guess local says it all. and also work with TV and film for producing music for television and film as well.
I'm Wayne Ledbetter. I manage some producers, a couple of artists, and do film and TV placement. I've got about 60 artists that I represent for licensing songs in the TV, film, advertising, commercials, jingles, video games.
Okay, well, I had sent the panelists here kind of a list of questions and topics that we're going to talk about. This may meander a bit, and we may not get to everything on here. And so we'll, I guess we'll see what we can do in about the 1 hour or so that we have left. With that, the one topic that I want to start with is the concept of social networking. Steve and I had some conversations about this earlier last week. When we talk about social networking, we're essentially talking about some of these, the rise of some of these websites that help us all interact with each other, either in a professional manner, a social manner, or a business manner. These websites being things like Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, and I'd like to invite some panelists' thoughts, starting with Steve, about how are we going about in our industry using some of these different new social networking tools at our disposal.
Right. So I've got sort of a lecture on this. I won't go that far. But one of the interesting things about the evolution of social networking is, especially with LinkedIn, Facebook, and MySpace, is they have a structure such that LinkedIn is backstage. It's where VIP access only. It's people that you would have refer you or would want to be referred by. It's pretty limited in who gets in. Facebook is like the stage. It's a place where you live out your life. You can do live streaming. You do the status messages and all this. And you play on the stage with the other people you would have on the stage with you, essentially your family, friends, other people that are pretty much your peers and who you want to work with. MySpace is the audience. So you take all comers, essentially you trim the kitty porn, the LOL cats, all that stuff to make sure that it looks like there's somebody at your site. But this is a place where you broadcast out to multiple people for promo, and you also find other people that are promoting. So this is in each of these places, you reflect what their needs are. So in LinkedIn, you find people to refer, and you refer to people. You use them for what they're used for. For Facebook, you find what people are doing that are in your world. I have like 580 friends, and I know most of them very personally, and it's everybody I've known through my entire life. We had a high school reunion, 30th high school reunion, that people got on Facebook and posted like our grade school photos, because we went to a private school all the way through. And there were people I hadn't seen since I was 7 years old, and someone said in a comment, "I wonder where he went," and went and looked. And it turns out he's a lounge singer in New York on a worldwide tour right now. I hadn't seen him since I was 7 years old. I emailed him, and he said, "I can't believe it. Is that you?" Yeah. And the thing that was strange, I don't know, my dad, I was, as an aside, my parents were evangelists, and my dad was a ventriloquist. And he had a little black dummy named Joe. And it's David Raleigh. He was the only black child in the neighborhood. And he said, "Does your dad still have that dummy? He was the only other black kid I knew." And it was very interesting as far as the depth of life, because it's sort of like what they used to tell us heaven would be like. Everyone you've ever met is there. But which made me wonder, you know, there's a lot of people I'd rather not meet again, so it's not really that cracked up. So it's been really useful. So I live stream to my social graph. An autograph is yourself on paper. If you sign your name, that's your autograph. Your social graph is the top friends, the things you post in your status messages. That's your definition in cyberspace, pretty much. So people that live stream, like right now, I could say is talking, whatever. And I do put things out about it on that granular level and put out a lot of posts of scientific. How many are my Facebook friends in here? There's like half the room, and they can attest that I have.
We always know what you dance.
You always.
So I join your house.
The big thing, the other half is jealous that you're not.
Well, you're please.
I who you're doing it with?
Anybody here? Exactly. The other thing about that on the industry situation, how does this help your career? For instance, is that there is an associative situation where I say Steve is mastering. Or Steve is doing circuit board design, or Steve is doing whatever, when people need mastering of those 580 people, which are mostly in the music industry, then they say, oh, of course, Steve does that. And so they come to me. So if you maintain the people who, as well as your central location, sorry, guys, as well as the people that you're actually working with, you want to make connections with people that could be clients or that you want to work with, and then they can see what you're doing. And you'll be the first person they come to because they know that's what you're doing if you're appropriate. And it is the other thing is because it is a stage. Does everyone remember Talking Heads Stop Making Sense movie? Started off with a guy with an acoustic guitar and a boombox on a big flat stage. And it worked its way up to a complete huge production. Now, as a stage, you can use Facebook in any of those situations. It's just a guy with a boombox. And then MySpace is more something to stream out, and I'll let that go by.
Right on.
There you go.
The underlying question here is how do you go about using these sorts of things in what you do within the profession?
Well, I'm not as thrilled with all these social networking things as Steve is. I'm on all three of those, Facebook and LinkedIn and MySpace. And I did spend a lot of time originally on MySpace, you know, looking for fans for the band. You know, you get all these emails and stuff. I didn't find it very effective at all. So I stopped doing it because, time is time. I don't want to waste time. Facebook, Steve suggested that I get on, and suddenly people are coming at me, old friends and things like that, and that's great. But, you know, I think it comes down to the intention. What am I trying to do with these people? And also the sort of the breadth or depth of these relationships. Like, I would rather talk one-on-one to somebody and have a deeper relationship than put it out to a whole bunch of people. You know, that's my take. I don't know if it's more or less effective, but that's kind of where I'm coming from with the whole thing.
So I guess for the question of how I use social networking sites, I have a MySpace account that I don't check very often. I have a Facebook account that I am fairly active on, and I have a LinkedIn account that I'm not that active on, but it has, you know, relevant business information. One way I use MySpace is as a music fan. I know most bands. If I want to hear what they sound like, I see they're playing somewhere, maybe I'm interested. You know, I'll go see what they hear, see what they sound like on their MySpace page. Most fans have a MySpace page, not all. So I use it in that way. As the legal guy on the panel, I thought maybe I'd touch on something we discussed earlier. Is you can use MySpace, Facebook, these places as a way to get your music or get your product out there, whether it's photography, whether it's music, whether it's whatever. I think one thing that the recent sort of controversy and uproar regarding Facebook's change in its terms of use shows is that these can be tools that can help an individual that doesn't have a lot of money to promote their product without spending a lot of money, and reach a wide audience. At the same time, you know, most people go through and click through, you know, however many online licenses a day or a week without reading the terms, but it can have an effect. You know, when someone else like MySpace or Facebook or some other company is rerouting your content, distributing your content online, they are likely saying, okay, well, you give us the right to do this, that, 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 and the other. And, you know, if it's something you are intending to make a business out of or make money off of, it's worth understanding what they're saying they can do with your content, because it could affect whether you are able to, for example, grant an exclusive license to someone. Someone says, hey, I want to use your photo for an advertising campaign throughout the United States. We'll pay you lots of money if you can grant us an exclusive license to your photograph. Well, you already licensed Facebook. You already licensed MySpace to use that photograph, so you can't really grant them an exclusive license. So it's worth keeping in mind that when you're doing that, it's worth knowing what rights you are granting to others if you're going to be using social networking sites in that manner.
My take on it is from an avid user of all three. My perspective is I definitely use LinkedIn, Facebook, and MySpace, but the way Steve described it is exactly how I use it. LinkedIn is a very professional, very serious, hardcore. These are professionals in the industry that recommend me, know me, that I've worked with, that I hope to work with from a recommendation of someone else. This is when I put my best foot forward, these are people that I contact. In the Facebook realm, these are friends and colleagues and come one, come all, but if I don't know you, I'm probably not going to say yes. You know, this is kind of more of an intimate area, but it keeps you in track of what I'm doing. You stay in touch with who I am, where I'm going. I can update it from my cell phone if something fun just happened, if I'm doing something, if there's a great show tonight, and your chances are you're going to check my page, then come check it out. MySpace, who cares? Anybody who wants to be a part of it, come. You know, there's, and I hate to say this, but there's a thing with MySpace. If the more people that are prone to go to your site, the more I'm likely to add you. I'll add anybody. But there's it doesn't necessarily have to be a band. I want everybody on MySpace to come and look at what's going on with me. So there'll be, what do they call the Playboy pinup ladies who advertise on MySpace. They have 3 million viewers. Now that's a great niche. So somebody who wants to hear some music after they're done looking at at these pretty ladies, they want to click on this guy and say, hey, the more people that I can advertise to on MySpace, the more I feel like I'm marketing out to potential clients that may say, okay, I need you to come produce for me, or I'm a band that I like the way your music sounds. How'd you get it to sound that way? They may come to me as an engineer on a local level. So I use all three, and I use it exactly as Steve described it, but I also venture out past those sites, and I'm always looking for the next social network site that's going to be the big boom. And Plaxo may be the next LinkedIn, but you know they have all kind of extensions where you can do RSS feeds, and that may be the next big thing where people subscribe to your RSS feed, such as Twitter or something like that, so that you can stay in connection with a lot of different people all at once, just from a simple passing of your time. You're sitting at the airport, let them know what's going on. I'm flying to such and such. Now you've just hit 13,000 people if you've got that many people on you know, on your RSS feed that subscribe to it. So there's always something coming up next. So I'm always looking for what's the next big thing. And in the meantime, I'm maintaining those networks. But it definitely is a consuming thing, so I try to limit it to a once or twice a week thing to where I get into these social network sites, because it'll take away a lot of your free time if you know that computer. It's the devil's work playground, I promise you that. So that's how I look at it.
Well, I'm very similar to Michael. I've got LinkedIn, Facebook, and MySpace. I rarely use LinkedIn. I look at it periodically. Facebook is high school friends and, you know, a few other people beyond that, but it's like, oh, wow, that guy, I haven't seen him in years. MySpace is, I probably use Facebook more than any of them. MySpace is a little bit more, I've got, you know, my top friends are some of my favorite clients that I work with. And I used to use it as a place to, hey, check out my MySpace. You can see some of the artists that I work with. More recently, I use it very infrequently for any kind of promotional things. I've got my website, which is very simple and password protected, so you can't even get in there unless I've given you a password. But my intern books concerts at a university. And recently, he's been using MySpace to kind of a little bit of a litmus test of, all right, somebody suggested I bring this artist in, and we look at how many plays they've had. And if they've got a million plays, then it's like, oh, wow, maybe I should bring them in.
Or else they have a spoofing play counter.
Yeah, but there's some of these things you can kind of look at to some degree a legitimate aspect of, you know, a quick, wow, is this someone legitimate or not? You know, someone with 2,000 plays as opposed to 4 million, you know, a little bit of a story going on is like, wow, maybe people will come out to this. And that's been a determination on some of the artists that he's been able to book. Now, also on MySpace, I use that also as, you know, I don't have artists send me CDs anymore at all. I'd rather not. Send me a link to your MySpace. And if they don't have a MySpace, then I don't even want to hear it, basically, if you're not that organized as an artist. But I use that instead of CDs as a start. You know, I first hear it from there, and then from there kind of move forward. But that's always a start of where I first get my first taste of what that artist is like.
The other thing for music promotion that brought this up, there's a place called SoundCloud that allows you to embed a little player of a song into a MySpace comments field. So if you go to the Playboy Bunny place and put your song in their comment field, it's a WAV file with a play button, and you're probably going to be heard quite a bit. And there's a share and there's a buy link that's embedded in that, and it's been very useful. And if you go to bands that are like your band, that you'd like to be, you know, if you like that, you'd like this, and post that in the comments field. That's another great device.
Just out of curiosity, amongst everybody out there, who has a MySpace page? If I raise a hand, and then how many Facebookers?
Yes, but I don't admit
it. I never use it. I find it a total waste of time for me.
And then finally, LinkedIn.
Object of observation.
So it kind of seems that they have a tendency to go together. I saw a lot of similar people raising hands that, by and large, if you're into one, you're into all of them.
I'd just like to make a comment that I've spent a lot of time with security, and there's in the last, just 30 days, there's been 80 different viruses in MySpace and Facebook, Mac and PC. And the latest ones, the Arc Trojan, the Arc Poison, actually harvests all your bank passwords. So if you're going to be in a social network environment, be sure that the very latest or whatever tool you choose to use, be sure it's fairly updated, because these things are changing very quickly.
It's like walking through a city in a dangerous part of town.
Yeah.
I mean, because people are saying, but I can get in trouble there. Well, yeah, if you walk downtown at night, you're probably going to get in trouble.
So I think a lot of people are naive, and what's happening is people that have connections to their corporate networks, their kids are using Facebook, and they're actually behind the firewall to tell them to the corporate network, and they're getting smashed. And we've been doing more and more forensics, and 90% of the viruses we found in the last 30 days are MySpace and Facebook.
And are these things where you have to open a message, or...?
It can be on a browser page. If the new Norton actually has an alert, it's in the browser. And so anytime the link is directing to a place that's not what the link says it is,
fishing.
You know, it's a fish hit or something like that. It has phishing responses. It has all kinds of things you can see. You can actually log it. And you can watch, in the course of a 3-hour Facebook session, you can see 20 different kinds of attempts.
So, kind of with that, I think I'll start down here on the other end with Wayne. Are websites, like a specific URL, maybe going away? That I guess to put a point on it, when I started my law firm, when I was a solo guy a couple of years back, it was very important to me to get a URL on there and have sort of a professional presence like any other law firm would. I wonder, in our industry, being the music one, is there any need for an actual URL, a specific website that you...
It's like putting your name in the phone book. You know, it's a way that people can find who you are and contact you. So if you ever had any need for that, I think, yeah, it's useful to have that. I'd say it's more useful to have that. It would be a Yellow Pages ad these days. It legitimizes to some degree who you are in some ways, too, that if it's a real business, they probably have a website. If they don't, you kind of question a little bit how legitimate it is.
I think, we talked about the MySpace and the Facebook and your LinkedIn. There's got to be a little bit more beyond that, though. People who are interested enough to come to your site, as far as the MySpace, they're going to say, okay, this is great, but now what are you really doing? Everybody's got this. So like Wayne was saying, it's an advertisement, but if they're looking for something a bit more, it's good to have a URL link directly to who you are, your entity, or whatever business that you're trying to drive. Once they go to your MySpace, they're going to say, okay, well, band website, and they'll click there. They want something more in-depth. They want more songs. They want more opportunities to see what you're doing. As far, if you're a business, they want to be able to contact your business. If you're an artist, they want to be able to follow your shows. So a URL is definitely beneficial. I think, like Wayne said, it gives more legitimacy to who you are and what you're doing.
I would agree with that in almost all cases. I mean, maybe if you have your own website, but you don't update it or you don't keep it or it doesn't look good or something, maybe it can do more harm than good. But I think, maybe if you're a band, maybe you don't need your own web page. But, I mean, if you're some other kind of business, I would think, maybe it'll change in the future, but I think a lot of people would think, well, if you don't have your own website, you seem less established or you seem a little more suspect. So I think URLs are still, in almost all cases, something you would want.
Yeah, I completely agree with these guys. MySpace is, anybody can do it, and it's great, and you should, I think, as an artist. But if you're serious, get serious. Do something for real that makes you look like you're doing something for real. It's like you can write on the CD or you can make some decent packaging, Same song is going to be perceived a lot better, in my opinion, if you have a decent website.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's different between now and say, a year ago or even 2 years ago, is it used to be that you did need to keep your website up really regularly. But now, fortunately for me, I've got a website that has a whole lot of stuff on it, and if people just run into me for the first time, they can go and they can explore through a whole lot of stuff, and I've got, enough to keep somebody busy for way too long, which is great, on all the different things I do. So I haven't really changed my actual website for over a year, but the other aspects are the current pieces. If people come to my MySpace, the nice thing, there's a thing called HelloText.com that does status messages out, you put them in one place, and it takes it and it updates the status message in LinkedIn, Facebook, MySpace, Flickr, and Twitter. So one place, it shows if someone's looking for activity, if they get into me by any of those other aspects, they're able to see it without having to work too hard at it, because one of the links on my website is social networks. So boom, you can then find me through the social networks. And the link to the website is on all the other social networks. So that's the real key, is it's like the foundation, that the base of the pyramid has to be your website, because that's really where you're working from, and that should have all of your business situations. But then as people get more churn in the relationship, then it goes sort of up Maslow's hierarchy of needs until you actually start to work with me, and that goes through the MySpace, if you're lucky enough, Facebook, if you're lucky enough, LinkedIn. and then the Twitter, anybody can... Now, Twitter's something we hadn't talked about before, but in the way that you've got the backstage, stage, and audience for the other three, Twitter is like telepathy. It's where you can actually...
The guys in the parking lot.
You can detect... Well, it's not the... Yeah, it's not... Yeah, the stoners in the front. No. It's how you can detect the state of another human being at a distance immediately. And it's pretty interesting when it's used that way. So anyway, my status messages go out to all of those situations too. But absolutely, the website is...
What tool to sync those?
Pardon me?
What tool?
HelloText.com. Hello. It's HelloTXT.com. It works really well. It points to all of the social... It has like 26 different social networks. that if you're on them, and that's if you want to find out what the next big thing is. And I think we're almost past the era of the next big thing. I really do, because I think things are starting to establish enough with Web 2.0 that you have silos of functionality. And that's what we got, that backstage, stage, and audience. Those are silos of functionality that, that as people learn to use them as that, they sort of attach them together in Flickr for photos and YouTube for video. It's like Legos, right? So you get it all stacked up. There's not really going to be a next big thing Lego, right? We already have the video deal. If somebody tries to do, and that's the iTunes for what iTunes does. When people try and come up with new business models, and this is one of the things that I think we've passed through that catalyzing time frame. That's why we're in a very interesting time frame. That the winners have won. And now it's time to use it. Like for any type of connections, you have three things for connections. You have the pipe, you have the interface at each end, and you have the content that goes through it. If any of those things are broken, it's not going to flow. But you've got basically the creator and the consumer, and you've got the music that goes between them and the method that that happens. And we're pretty much zeroing in on a methodology, and that's what tonight's about, is we're pretty much zeroing in on a methodology. I don't see it evolving too much beyond that. Like Plaxo, it's been around for a few years, and there's basically a business card back end. And they've always frustrated me because they want to have these automated, you know, join us type of thing.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that sort of shifted.
I will say I've seen that websites have had increased functionality. Instead of just being a place for information, it's now a tool that you use. You can go there to sign up on the email list rather than going to a show to do it, and it comes right in as an email to the artist. I use it with my website. You know, it's a very private thing. I just have basic information up there, but I use it with producers and directors where we need this, and I'll literally post a folder for them that I've got an embedded player within my site that they can go and audition things and download them based on what they're looking for. I've had artists that, you know, like a Sonic Bids kind of thing where they put up a private page that has all their songs able for download, high-res photographs and video things for promotional uses. That using the website, I think, rather than just information, for actual functionality a little bit more than they used to be.
You can even put a store in the back end now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's another one of those Web 2.0 siloed functionality situations where they're providers of these narrow functional blocks. And what's a mistake for, I think, up-and-coming businesses is where they're trying to grab too many of those. Mm-hmm. Online, you really want to try and narrow your capability where you're interoperable with everything else, but you don't offer everything. It's not no longer walled gardens. Walled castles are like AOL used to be. Mm-hmm. This is way last century. You know, so
let me throw this out there. And, Jeff, I'm going to start with you as we proceed through the panel here. Can the tools that we use here supplant the function of sorts? And by that I mean what we're using these things for is, for the most part, to increase our ability to do business with people and interact with people. And in the music industry, to a large extent, it's very much a people-oriented business of sharing music with others and sharing that experience of I am the artist and you are my fan or vice versa, or any number of things there. Can you, in your opinions, can we supplant the function of that by having a great tool that just takes away the relationship and turns it into the digital world that we have now?
Well, I mean, obviously the internet is a massive way to connect to a zillion people. Doing that effectively is the trick, right? There's a million bands on MySpace, but how many of them are really selling anything to anybody? You know, I don't know what the numbers are, but I doubt most bands are selling much. And part of that is a function of the quality of their music, and part of it is a function of there are a million bands there, like literally. So who's going to buy it? Figuring out how the stuff works, yeah, it's a huge question. What's effective? I don't know. I wish I did. I would be doing it. I mean, I've tried these different things. I've tried the MySpace thing. You know, one of my general rules, I think, in, you know, life and marketing and stuff like this is that if you take the easiest way, and, you know, easy is a tricky word, but if you do things that everybody else is doing, you're doing the same thing that everybody else is doing, which means you're going to, everything gets watered down. So, you know, I think outside of the way that everybody's doing something, and sooner or later you're going to hit a really smart way to use the internet, or not use the internet, use things around the internet. What is my example of this? I don't know. But there's bound to be some solution that actually works.
Can I make one comment? The what I've noticed the biggest difference between Web 1 and Web 2 is in Web 1, the company controlled the content. So the mission was, you know, Cisco to get their manuals out, the Rolling Stone to get their latest record out. The whole social networking phenomenon and the YouTube phenomenon is the company builds an infrastructure that the users contribute the content. And they make money off of how many users they can get, because they can attract advertisers and scale and other things. And so one of the things that's going on here is in the old days, the mission was to control the spin. You know, how a company was perceived was the first thing they did on their website, was say, this is our image, we're going to feed it to you. And now what's happening is the impact of the material is often created by the audience itself. And so you can't control the reviews of your last album, you know. And so it's, like you're saying, to vote the fans, go see who's got that many downloads. That's an example of how the instant polling and the value is in the contribution of the audience more than what the band is putting out there is interesting. But what's more interesting is the effect of the user contributing content. And in the case of some of these places, they're getting user-contributed content from the creators and the audience for free. You know, the bands are putting their stuff up, waiving their copyrights to some degree or another. Some of them are smart enough to only put 30-second clips up rather than the whole record. Or that's their strategy. Give away the music, make money on merch. You know, whatever the new strategies are. So it's a shift in where the value is coming from.
Sounds like it's like a water wheel instead of a pump. Where instead of raising the water yourself, you basically let the water flow over you and turn it.
I think in terms of whether these tools can sort of, you know, like you said, they're tools to facilitate people coming together with other people. They also may supplant it in a way that, you know, the way that recorded music can. You know, maybe you can listen to a CD so you don't have to go out and see the band in person. Maybe you really like going out and seeing the artist because you get that connection. Well, now you feel like you have a connection because you're their MySpace or Facebook friend. I think, as a practical matter, I don't think it's necessarily that likely that having your Facebook or MySpace connections is going to stop people from coming to your shows. Maybe some people feel like they get enough of a connection not going to the shows, but you're going to be reaching so many more people. I think in most cases, it's the promotion is going to draw more attention to you and not necessarily supplant any sort of personal interaction. I think one good thing it does is, you know, a lot of people have said success in the music industry depends a lot on who you know more than what your music is like. Well, with Facebook or MySpace or other, you know, online distribution mechanisms, you don't need to know anyone to get your music out to the masses. You don't need to know someone at a record label to get a physical CD distributed to lots of retail stores. You just need to put it on the website, and millions of people can see it. Now, whether they will see it, it's not being pushed out like a pump. You know, maybe some people, you know, the word of mouth will get it drawn to your site. But it means you don't necessarily need this pump mechanism of a big record label or something doing advertisement and distribution of a physical product for you. So I think that in a good way is can supplant, you know, personal relationships that might otherwise have been necessary to reach a wide audience.
My question is actually in response to you, Jeff, is that really true? Because it seems like it has, quote, been disintermediated. yet there's the record companies, even though they're weak, they still exist and still do a useful function, because how do we choose? There are no agents to choose among those million bands on MySpace. I certainly don't want to go through it. And so how do you balance those two? Yes, everything's there, but it's like selling a product. You can get distribution, but unless there's sell-through, you're not making any money. So my question
is
to you about
that. That is totally my experience, is that it's very difficult. You can put it on, you can put your CD on CD Baby, you can put your songs on iTunes, you can put your stuff on MySpace or whatever, and so what? It doesn't matter, because people still have to find it. And then, you know, the next problem is, well, why isn't it free? You know, that's a whole other thing, right? You know, I'm trying to make a living making music, and it's hard. So I still think that you do need the connections. You do, you know, hey, if I get a review in Rolling Stone, I will sell music. There's no doubt about it. How am I going to get that? My record company hopefully has a good relationship, hopefully gets it to happen. If I'm a completely independent band and I call up Rolling Stone, there's no way that review is going to get in there. So I think it still is, you know, and money behind it and expertise and relationships to a large degree.
I think that's true. I don't think it has supplanted other traditional distribution and promotion mechanisms. I think it's made the disparity a little less.
I'd go for that.
I've got a couple bands that don't have record labels, per se, but they've got some investors, and they're just as successful doing it independently on their own, not having to go through this system, so to speak.
I think that's the way of the future right there.
Yeah, it's having the resources.
The
record companies are phasing out their publicists. They're hiring outside publicists. They've got one product manager that oversees your publicist, your artwork, and all these other things. So even at a record company, they're going to say, okay, we're going to hire this outside publicist. We're going to hire this outside radio promotions firm because it was too expensive to have our own radio promotion staff anymore. We're going to hire this outside artwork person. Like, who's to say you can't do that on your own? What the record companies offer, the only thing they can really promise anymore is money. And give you a way to fund things.
Well, if that's their core value add, then investors can do that faster.
Absolutely.
And cheaper.
Absolutely.
Who needs the big infrastructure of, you know, 50 drug addicts taking takes on payola?
That's the big
question. You can have a bunch of individuals and have a few bucks.
I've got a lot of artists that prefer not to. That, you know, they'd say, well, if we get distribution through a major record label, then it's got, you know, it might have a few more people that it gets to, but we're giving up 85% mm-hmm. to that company and we're never going to get and recoup our advances. Can we sell 100,000 with the record company? Yeah, maybe we can. Can we sell 10,000 on our own and make more money? Yeah.
Yeah.
The decision's an easy
decision
to make.
The rights packages. One of the things that made me almost insane when I was doing the WeedShare content stuff is to reviewing exclusive artist contracts for record labels, and you read through this, and I almost just collapsed sobbing on the floor, considering, you know, the way I feel for artists is you sign away your name, your appearance, basically every photograph that's ever been taken of you, they now own, and there's the, what is it, the egregious
360
benefit? Yeah. No, the problem of if, once we sign this, if you tell other people that we're doing bad things to you, then we can sue you for greater harm. There's a legal term.
Libel and slander.
It's even beyond that. It's like maximum damages or something. It's extraordinary damages.
Treble.
Yeah, so
liquidated damages clause.
Everybody knows what treble is.
The massive treble. that's high end, right? but that was just traumatic, actually, to read what people actually. So what I came up with is that this is cruel tricks played on children by adults. You are set and tuned as a child to want to be signed. Mm-hmm. Once you're signed, it's called indentured servitude. You get when you're done, if you don't owe $2 million, you're probably doing pretty good.
Well, if you're... But, 99% of all artists signed to major labels never recoup their initial grants.
This is where it's interesting with Jeff, because you were signed.
Right. I'm at the beginning of something that will hopefully be good for me. And it's a little bit different than a regular record deal. I created this YouTube tribute myself. I have the studio, I paid the singers, you know, all that.
And the mastering.
So I own the recording. U2 owns the publishing, obviously. I didn't write the songs. So I'm licensing this, you know, to these labels. And as far as I can see, the deal is as fair, quote, as it's, you know, going to get, you know, the thing in the music industry is it's not, if you're going to get screwed, it's how much. So we'll find out. But the good news is I own this recording, and at the end of the term of 3 to 5 years for these different companies, I get the recording back. If they did a great job, great, they can have it again, and we all keep making money. And if not, hopefully I can go to another label and, you know, do better over there. So I don't know what's going to happen with this, but I feel like this is a really good spot to be in because I have control over my recording, you know, and I license that out in different countries.
Yeah, a distribution deal rather than a master-owning deal.
Right. Record deal. Yeah, they don't own me. They're you know, we're working together on this.
What's great about that is there's usually a limited period of time, and the rights revert after that period of time.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's usually a more balanced split than an artist deal.
My deals are 3 to 5 years, and at the end, we renegotiate or stop.
The weird thing in the modern day, and I want you to talk to this, is that your deals are territorial. So you've got, like, Germany and Switzerland and something, and then your French guy fell through, and then you've got Britain, you got the North America. And in the days of internet, it's very interesting. Can you speak to some of that?
Yeah, I'll tell you all a very interesting story that happened just in the last week or two. So the French deal fell through. This multi-million dollar label called me 2 weeks before it was supposed to be released. Sorry, we went out of business. Your record's not coming out. Great. Thank you very much. I've been working on that for 24 years. However, the first deal came out in Germany in November. And the deal there is to sell it digitally and, you know, CDs in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. Okay, so that's going and that's fine. Just 2 weeks ago, I signed with the record company Koch here in the USA. And that is for just the USA and Canada. So a couple days after we agreed to this deal and, you know, finally worked out the contract and stuff, my brother's on the internet and looks at iTunes and he's like, hey, man, your record's on sale on the U.S. iTunes. And I go look at it and I'm like, wow, it's the German record cover on there. I'm like, oh, geez, this is not good, right? The German, they're supposed to be selling it over there, not here. So I call my lawyer and he says, okay, just write him a letter, write him an email, tell him what's up and be cool and hopefully it's just a mistake and we'll figure it out. So email the label in Germany. The next day I get a response. And the response is, well, we looked at the U.S. iTunes store, and our version of your record is not on sale in the U.S. iTunes store. That's your U.S. deals record in the U.S. However, the U.S. label also has it on sale in Germany. I'm like, oh, my God. These people are all selling this record in the wrong place, you know? So then I have to call, you know, get the lawyer to call Koch, and now, you know, they're taking care of this. But it just speaks to how interconnected this all is, and, you know, you push a button and it's on sale in a country, and these are big companies that aren't screwing around. They're, you know, there could be problems if this isn't, you know,
now, did
solved.
You try clicking on it? I did recently try to buy a song. It showed up on the U.S. iTunes, but I went to click to buy it, and it wouldn't allow me because it was an English only.
Right. Mm. Yeah, they have it separated so that you can't...
You can see it, but you can't purchase it. If you're
right.
And you can log into a Brit, the Brit store. Record label store, and it doesn't bring it to you either. So. Same thing. You know, it's the same kind of territory. That's where the territorial things are also, I think, going to be absolutely gone before too long just because of this emerging global consciousness. We can't be schizophrenic so much anymore. I think it's breaking down by languages, maybe. So if you have the iTunes in Germany is cool because English speakers aren't probably going to go to Germany, et cetera, and the French and all the different languages. But beyond languages, I don't know of any very good distinguishing situations
well,
in the net.
The distinguishing situation, in my opinion, is that, you know, I want these labels, you know, if I have these labels behind me, they need to promote it in their territories. Like, if it's, you know, on sale in Japan and nobody's pushing it, who cares? It's not really going to sell that much. So that's why I think you need this separated so that they can be promoted properly in the different territories.
So for promotions, what you're getting, that's what
you're
getting.
Well, and there's localization of the IPs. The global IP scheme is localized by country. When you log in and send a HTTP request, it knows it's coming from the United States. That's why when you're in Japan using your computer, you go to Google, it turns into Japanese. Mm. Because it knows localization by region from the ISP map. Mm. And so it knows. The network knows where the request is coming. It's very clear. And Apple particularly has the engineering together. So it knows which iTunes store it should be in.
It's an interesting story. I signed a band in Maverick Records and ended up meeting the manager of the Muse before they released it in the States. And they had done really well in England. And the way that he had done his deals, he has gone, he basically, they blew up in England first. And they decided to go to every country and do a separate deal in every country. Basically, they did a U.S. deal. They did a Japan deal. They did a Benelux deal. They did a, some of these other kinds of, you know, wherever territory it was. And it created a lot of confusion for a lot of consumers initially. But in the States, I love this story just because I hated the guy at Maverick. And it was the guy who was here, he was the head of Maverick. He was just one of the most pretentious people you'd ever meet in your life. Signed their first record, put it out, it did okay. Second record gets delivered to Maverick. Maverick says, we don't think it's that great. We're not going to pick up the option on it. That record was their second record, sold 2 million copies in the UK. Sold a ton of imports. The only way you can get it in the States was as an import. Third record came along, Maverick's parent company, Warner Brothers, Perry Watts Russell, they signed it. And that was what blew them up in the States, that third record. Their parent company signed it, and they had egg on their face from picking up the option on their second
What's
record.
What's
that? Muse.
Muse. Oh, okay.
Muse. But they had done a deal where it was every country on that, I think it was on that second record, every country had a separate deal. So U.S., Maverick had it, and they didn't put out the option on it. So the only people in the States, they could get it from Canada, they can get it from the U.K., but you can only get it as an import.
I don't think the... I think you missed the last question coming past. Jumped right over you.
Yeah, I think we covered it. So just, I mean, this feels like I'm backtracking at this point, but my comment to that is that these are all tools. These are... Like we've all discussed, these are just tools that we utilize. I can go get a hammer, some nails, and you know, some 2x4, but that doesn't mean I could build a house. And what the record labels and what people that you know and people that you meet along the way, they're experts in their field. And I think this is a good situation we're in here, which is an example of several different individuals that have expertise in certain fields. As a collective, we could put out something and it could be the biggest thing in the world. But individually, for us to try to helm this on, or take all this on, our marketing, our advertising, our record sales, our distribution, our engineering, our producing, our, you know, the whole one-stop shop that this opportunity of social networking and the home recording studio has presented to us, we're kind of kids in a candy store and we don't know what to grab first. And we're not going to build the best house on the market, so to speak, by doing it all by yourself. So it presents a form, it presents an opportunity, but also you have to utilize the tools at your hand and know when to take these tools out of your hand and give it to the carpenter and say, okay, here, you build this for me and I'm just going to pay you for it. And I think there's a separation that has to be made within yourself to say, hey, I'm not the expert in this field, let me give it to somebody else who is. And I think that's a boundary that you have to cross, and it's a personal matter to most individuals who think that they can do it on their own. But if you see it's not working, it's not that it won't work, it's just that you have to approach it from a different aspect and a different angle. So don't let the tools overwhelm you, but they're great tools in the right hands of the right individual.
Cool. All right, here's a question I've been dying to ask of an entire group like this, and I'm going to throw this out. Mike, you're getting an answer first. What is the value of recorded music? And by that, I mean, one, does it even have value anymore? To some extent, it used to be $9 for 10 songs on a cassette tape. It turned into somehow $15 on a CD. But now it's down to $1 per song when you get it through the computer, or less, or more. Or, for that matter, when you get it from some other location, when you just simply download it and don't pay for it at all, well, then the price of that is now less than 99 cents. Does recorded music in and of itself have any value given where we are in today's technology?
I think the short answer is yes,
I think, I mean, the value of music, whether it's recorded or otherwise, is how it makes you feel. It makes you feel happy. You like listening to it. In comparing recorded music to live music, well, the value is you can listen to it whenever you want, wherever you want. So it may cost less to produce it now than it used to. It may be free or almost free to distribute it now in comparison to distributing a physical object. But it still has value because people still want it. A lot of people are still willing to pay for it. Now, the only reason or the main reason I think that a lot of people aren't paying for it isn't because it doesn't have value to them. It's because they can. And if you can not pay for something as opposed to paying for something, a lot of people will do it. You know, whether they justify that they should be able to do that, they don't think about the consequences, or they, you know, to the artist or the other, you know, other myriad of people involved in producing the music, or maybe they do and they think, well, I still think it's justified. I don't think that means that it doesn't have value. I think anyone who wants to listen to recorded music and wants to listen to it, you know, whenever or wherever they want, places value on it. Whether or not people can and who can harness that value and make a living off it, I think that may change based on enforcement of intellectual property rights, the ease of marketing, distribution, creation of the music based on new technology. And so, you know, the people who are harnessing the value or getting profit off of that value may change as technology changes, but I don't think music is any less valuable. I think the amount people are willing to pay and the number of people who are willing to pay that amount may have changed due to the technology and due to being able to get away with not paying for it. But I think it still has value to, I mean, I think everyone in this room would say, well, you know, I value the experience of being able to listen to music and not necessarily having to go listen to someone play a lot. They like being able to listen to music in their car. Like being able to listen to music when they're jogging or whatever. So I think recorded music still has a lot of intrinsic value. It may be difficult and challenging to harness that value for the people who are trying to profit off its production and sale.
I think a lot of things to that. There's some historical things that I think have led to where we're at. And I think a lot of that was from the record companies, where they would put out a CD, it would sell well, they would sell the singles, the commercial singles would sell well as well, and they started saying, well, these commercial singles, they're outselling the records. Well, the reality was the record wasn't good enough to sell a whole CD worth, and if you could get just the one song you wanted, they did. And they decided, this is cannibalizing our album sales, let's get rid of those things. So they started selling, you know, the Chumbawamba example, where you have this band with one good song and you're selling it for $15, and that's $15 for the one song you want, isn't really worth it to people. I think people, even bands that I've had with major labels, you know, the A&R guys that say, all I care about is three singles, whatever you do and the rest, I don't care. And that was the mentality for a long time. So what went for a long time was you have this collection that was an album and you wanted to listen to the album all the way through, and it was 9 tunes instead of 15 that it is now. There's some congruity to it. There's some, you listen to the radio, you had the bends, you listen to it all the way through. You don't pick your favorite songs off of it necessarily. Okay, Computer kind of had that vibe. But I think while that happened, they got rid of the commercial singles. The albums got more single-oriented because that's historically what they could work well with. They had the DVDs coming out, and DVD prices, instead of rising, which CDs were, they're dropping. And you can go to the CD store, and you can get the DVDs over here for $10 or $15. You can buy the CDs for $10 or $15. Perceived value, it's $100 million to make a movie. It's, you know, nowhere near that to make a record. Why are those prices coming up, and why are the CDs going down? At the same time, what happened is you saw the rise of Xboxes, PlayStations, and all the little console video games, and the core music audience that live and eat, breathe, and die by their music are the 13 to 18-year-old kids who now, are you going to buy a video game for $30, $40, $50, or are you going to buy two CDs for that? And I think you can get a lot more entertainment over a longer period of time than a CD that you don't even know if it's good until you listen to it. So I think historically what led to where we're at is, and that's the same time that the Napster, suddenly you can get whatever you wanted for free. So there was like, well, you can get it for free. It isn't really worth that anymore. Everybody knows it. It's not worth $15 for a CD. As soon as you got the iPod, it's like, I don't even want the CD anyway. You know, I'm just going to rip it onto my computer, and then it goes onto a shelf, or who cares where it goes to. So I think the perceived value
yeah, you can get it for free. I think there is, like we said, I think there's a value of music, but I think there has to be that supply and demand. And right now, the price is too high, even at $1 for the iTunes store. I think if you drop that price, I think you can get exponentially more people buying music, arguably driving up the price, and seeing higher profits from that, because people get iPods, they want to film. Rather than buying everything, you know, a kid's not going to buy 15,000 songs on iTunes at $1 a piece, but they want to be able to fill it with what they've got. So are they going to buy the few things that they want and then get them other places? Sure. The idea that all mp3.com selling downloads for 5 cents a piece did great. It was a loophole in Russia. It was a site for a while. But in answer to your question, yes, there is a price for it. I think it's a lot lower than it is now even. But I think there's a lot of historical things that have led to a perceived value of what music is and what it should be.
Yeah, recorded music.
Yes, recorded music.
Yeah, going and writing what Wayne said, I just think you have to be true to what the product is. A dollar for one song is too much. A quarter for a song may not be too much, but it may be too much for some. You know, unknown artists who no one knows about that's trying to circulate their music throughout the marketplace and find clientele, you might want to give it away for free. You might want to offer that free download. You might want to offer your whole first album for free in hopes that the audience that you generate may give you exposure for your next album to where you can charge a quarter. There's sacrifice, but I just don't see myself going to buy an independent artist's song unless they blew me away at some show that I showed up to randomly, going on iTunes and buying their entire album for 99 cents a track and, you know, spending, you know, my last 10 that I could put in my gas tank with it, you know. These are practical thoughts that go through, you know, the human process. You
opportunity
know.
Costs.
Exactly. So it's just you have to be real. You have to be a realist and not expect the world. Just because the top-selling artist in the world is selling it at this price, that means that I put my heart and soul into it. Now I should get that as well. And my product sounds better. Of course it does to you because you just poured your heart out. But does it really to the world who doesn't know you? So that's you got. It's a give and take. There is value, but you have to establish your value first. You have to establish your market value.
Yeah.
I got a question. You would be the press one to answer, Jeff.
Yeah.
It's clear the business model is broken. I mean, Nokia is trying to package phones comes with music as a way to salvage that. That may be a Hail Mary pass. It brings some revenue back. You buy a phone for $300 and you get a year's worth of unlimited all you can eat. But my question is more fundamental. The way the music business works, forgetting about the business side, on the production side, you have typically, as I understand it, a singer-songwriter does his whole thing soup to nuts. In the film business, each function is siloed off. There's a cinematographer. There's a director. There's a yada, yada, yada. There's a lighting guy. There's a scene guy. In the old days, I thought that there were writers, Tin Pan Alley writers, who wrote the songs. There were singers, there were arrangers. Everything was specialized like the film business used to be. It seems maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago it shifted where the singer-songwriter would have to do their own thing. I think the reason that underlies your comment, Wayne, that why albums really didn't sell that well is that most musicians aren't good enough to write an entire album and perform the music that's worth anything.
Yeah.
There's a few Beatles, there's a Rolling Stones, there's yada, 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 but most artists simply cannot do everything. But on the other hand, you don't expect, and in the film business, the famous directors, he's not the actor. Everyone does their own little thing specialized. So the question is, can that film model translate to the music business where you then redivide the functions where you got writers, you got the technical people, and you got the performers? That's my question to you, because your product is actually taking great U2 tunes
right.
and partnering it with performers who may be good, but we never heard of.
Right. Well, I think that's, you know, my case with this U2 record is a little different than most of what's out there, which is, original songs. But you're right, totally. There are great songs. I picked the songs that I love and everybody else loves, and I found great singers, and, you know, hopefully my production and arrangements and stuff like that turn it into something of value. I'm well aware that people who buy this record are not buying it because I did it. They're buying it because it's U2 songs, and just so happens that I did it. However, hopefully that will also generate a much larger fan base for me, and they will turn around and buy my previous two original records and hopefully future records as well. So, yeah, it's a great idea, but if you talk to, an indie rock band here in Seattle and say, hey, you know what, you guys, your songs really aren't that good. Why don't we have somebody else write the songs? Because the singer's good and you guys can play. And then we'll get a producer in here to kind of tell you how to, you know, clean that up. They'll freak out. There's no way. I mean, most bands, you know, a lot of bands that I talk to anyway.
Because you're a producer as well.
Yeah, because I'm a producer as well. You need a producer. Every decent band that's ever, almost every decent band that's ever made a record has had a separate producer. But nobody thinks they need one, you know, now, right? They can do it. They have Pro Tools.
I got a bedroom.
Did someone here earlier, I think, said they worked in Nashville for a bit? I was going to say, I think that's still a fairly common model of country music, where you've got the dedicated songwriter, and they're not the person who's singing on the album. And that has worked pretty well for them.
But this is where the opportunity is. The record companies used to provide half a dozen functions. They provided finance, promotion, A&R, editorial, long-term funding. You know, three record deal. U2 was quoted as saying, if they were in the world today, they would have never gotten their second record. They would have never had it. They would have been dropped after their first record. You know, so we have to look at all of those functions, the art department, the marketing, design, production, engineering, and realize only a couple of things have changed. You know, you're right, you don't need CBS New York anymore and a union engineering guy to do a recording. You don't need $1 million to build a studio. You can build one for $25,000 and make a decent recording. But you still need a producer, you still need an artist, you still need a song. But this is where the opportunity is, because with the internet, you could be in one place and do what you do for people all over the world. And they've got websites now where you can send a song to somebody, and they'll put a band together, a rhythm track together for you, yeah, with real session men, you know, for $100 a track. And you'll get a real guy that's a platinum album drummer, a real bass player, a real keyboard player, a real guitar player. They've got Internet Jock is a website that does voiceovers now. You can send your script anywhere. You can pick from 100 different, you know, disc jockeys and get your commercial done in an hour. You know, so you can get voiceover talent. You can get guitar players. You know, somebody can solo on your record. The collaboration, and you can get an album designer. I know one woman is, I don't know her name, she's an alternative indie rock producer that's really great, that opened a studio in the middle of nowhere in, like, Weed, California. And she's got a complex that's got recording, website design, t-shirt production, album cover, lyrics, video. And the band will come over from Europe for 6 weeks, and they're ready to ship on tour for one price.
You know, there's your Legos, too, you know, right? There's
exactly.
Your building blocks.
So there's someone who's done the functional specs under one roof, but now we have the opportunity to be, you know, here's the A&R function. Wayne provides management, A&R, and promotion.
I'll do the mastering.
Yeah.
Highly recommend it, too.
That's the reality. This is where the opportunity is. The fact that you can get an investor, replace the cash of Columbia, and get your own art department,
right,
your own PR guy, because they don't exist anymore.
Well, it's orthogonal to the existing methods. It's so everything's like flat, and you're wondering how come everything is so bundled. Well, if you go this way, it's all good. I want to touch on this question and the concept of traction versus friction-free. Like MP3s, when I did WeChair, did I talk about WeChair at all? I had a music distribution system that called Wii. We used Windows DRM, plays for sure stuff. The way it worked is you get a Wii file, you can play it three times for free. On the fourth time, it says you seem to like this, time to buy it. If you choose to buy it, 50% goes to the artist, and your user ID is stamped into the file. You're encouraged to share it with as many people as you think might like it. They can hear it three times. If they choose to buy it, 50% goes to the artist, 20% goes to you for sharing it with them, 10% goes to who you got it from, and 5% goes to who they got it from. So if you have a celestial jukebox full of music, you can listen to things that only if you listen to it more than three times, you have to pay for it. When you have to pay for it, then, and the DRM provided the traction for this process. And that's the thing, is putting traction on the music. The way that I've talked to record label, like EMI guys that are right at the top, and they were hating all this the Napster stuff. I said, do you realize that when you sell a CD, it's not protected people? It's like locking the front doors but leaving the loading bays open. And everyone just runs in and takes it out. Do you realize that these doors are open here? But once it's out, it's out. So there's for business models to generate money, back to your question, does music have a value? I think we have to twist that with, does music have a monetizable value? I.e., can you put traction on recorded music? And to the answer to that is, I don't think so anymore. You sort of can in like iTunes. They're starting to do MP3s too, but as soon as it becomes a friction-free movement capability, until you get some method of generating traction, you've lost it. And so then you have to turn your head to, okay, what are my value adds around this? What silo can I inhabit that I do better than anybody else? And what I've done, I've used my Burning Sky Records label as sort of a test bed for a lot of this stuff. And we have bands that send us in their cover track. I get it via You Send It. I master it. I send it back, like, the same night typically, in a full mastered format plus an MP3. And in that way, I have communicated to bands who I like that are in things that I like, because of Jellyfish or Posies or Roxy, you know, these are people that I would like to be dealing with, and I can follow up with them. They've already done the process of sending me a song. They've heard what I can do. I've sent it back to them. And then typically they come back and I do their album. So now I've generated traction around the situation. Then we put it on the disc, and we have garages full of discs, so we give them away at AES meetings. You know, it's sort of challenging to get this stuff out, but we've used TuneCore and got everything on iTunes around the world, and all the different digital situations, which are going to generate over time. And this promotes all of these different bands around the world as well. But for me personally, the way that I put traction on the recorded music is by providing a service, and especially a process of how you get the track. It's a step function. You take what it is, make it better, give it back. I want to provide that lift. So for anybody's situation is, what lift do I provide to the situation? Okay, that's what I'm going to promote. And then you promote that niche of, I can give you art, or I can give you promotion or presentation or marketing or legal advice. So in answer to the question, I think that the value of recorded music, because it is now friction-free, as soon as somebody gets a CD, they can rip it, they can put it up, it's done. So that's
so let me ask this question. Let me put this scenario forward of sorts, that there was a very tangible and large amount of money that went from consumers' pockets to people who were selling music in the past. And that existed for a long time, whether it's cassette, CDs, vinyl sale, on up to the MP3. That exists. There was a lot of money that got transferred from A to B to purchase that music and the right to do things with it. If that goes away, does the money that was spent in the music industry in this manner find its way still back into the music industry, such that the music industry is still the same chunk of dollars, or all of a sudden is it going to go to the gaming industry or the film industry, which means ultimately the music industry has to shrink, and the number of people that are involved in making a living in the music industry has to shrink because there's too few dollars chasing it.
You read the newspaper, right?
Just the one.
Yeah. There's
what?
There's a thing called Digital Music News, DMN. I read every morning. There's a number of daily aggregators of news about music, which is really, there's some great things, and you get fully informed. I actually do it before I get out of bed, which is nice. That way I can know if I have some work to do. But what you described is this is the case. They're really, this is the fall of the music industry. It's not the fall of music, and this is a very important distinction to make. Music is stronger than it ever has been, as far as I can tell. Really. But the music industry is corroding and dissolving.
The record industry.
The record industry, right, especially. And those dissolved pieces, it's also putting a lot of really talented people out on the street that might be bored, that might be able to create something really wonderful in these more virtual corporations that just rise and then fall, as people understand that they are actually self-employed rather than looking for a new job in the industry. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that most people that are losing their jobs, I think, they don't realize they're freshly self-employed instead of looking for work.
Right.
So you got to accept that reality and find the lift that you can provide and go out and market that and do that.
You mentioned, you know, just people as being laid off and A&R people. I just want to mention just a statistic that I read the other day. Of the last 2 years, 400 A&R people that were at labels doing A&R lost their jobs, and of those 400, four found new places in the A&R world.
Right.
I was at Warner's in New York 2 weeks ago, and they had a sign at reception that said, "We can't afford a secretary. Please use your cell phone to call your party to have them come out through security measure." And it's like, everybody's gone.
And their stock value is, what, 173 now?
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. I mean, they don't have anybody. There's nobody who wants jazz anymore. So jazz what?
They don't need anything.
Well,
it's just a software program.
But it's really bad.
Well, their business model collapsed. It's over.
Yeah. CDs, you know, your question on the thing, are CDs dead? My answer, yes. I hate CDs. I hate flipping open the case. I hate when they crack. I hate it when they...
And the little picture on them, real teeny. The records, man, at least you could do something with the jackets.
Even that, I don't care about the liner notes. I can look on that and look online. You know, I don't read them like I used to as a kid. If I want the credits, I'll look and see, oh, yeah, you know, like I like Michael Brecker recordings. So I'll look, did he play on that track? Great. Otherwise, I won't listen to it. And I'll look online, and I'll make a note in iTunes which ones he played on. The CD is dead. I think, you know, anybody who has an iPod, you know, realizes that they hate these janky little packages of CDs, and I've got a shelf in a bedroom upstairs with about 2,000 of them that half of them are still in plastic from when I worked at labels.
Mm-hmm. So let me posit this, then. If you two themselves said that they probably wouldn't have gotten their second deal in today's environment, if there's just not enough money going to go into producing the kind of talent that can support a U2 to become U2, does the world have less art? Mm. Can art...
American Idol is around.
Can it be you two specifically posited that they would not have become the artists that they are now?
I think the world will continue to have plenty of art, as that, you know, there's plenty of people making music, and they're all going to put their stuff on MySpace or something like that. What's going to be lost is bands developing over time. U2 or, you know, any band generally gets. I don't want to say generally gets better over time, because that's not really true.
Great bands.
But
do.
What's that?
Great bands do.
Great bands do.
I think Rob mentioned that a lot of bands have, you know, there's a sophomore slump that kind of became the case after a band, you know, after the writers weren't writing for them anymore, because you spend all this time, you put out your first record, that's all your greatest stuff, second record comes along, and you've written all that.
Well, you've been on tour, right?
Yeah.
On tour of your first
record.
You're
on tour for most of that, you've got 6 months to do a new record. It's not your entire lifetime of built up, you know, ideas to go into your first record.
I saw U2's first tour at Astor Park. It was the most amazing thing, really. It was stunning. And I didn't really like their second album, or the rest of them. But the first stuff was just amazing, and you could tell that they, you know, here's some, and usually the good bands have really good drummers for some reason. You know, the ones you can tell are going to just last for a long time. But that's true.
Yeah, I was just curious kind of you all felt about music subscription services. I mean, it seems to me, and I'm totally guilty of it myself, but there's sort of this consumer conscious block as far as, you know, gravitating towards that. But it seems like that a lot of the problems that we're all talking about are kind of easily taken care of by basically the fact that you know, if you have this subscription service, you basically, you know, the people who get the more hits, the people, you know, they get more money. And I just wonder, I mean, even to myself, why is it that I'm willing to pay, you know, $50 a month for internet service? Why am I not willing to pay $15 a month to listen to any song that I want, whenever I want, as long as I just keep paying? Because I end up paying probably that much or a lot more, actually.
Right. Why buy it? Why not get friends to
it? I love Rhapsody.
Yeah.
Love Rhapsody so much. And my wife makes playlists that are just brilliant. And they've got probably more than half of our CD collection is on Rhapsody. And then 300,000 times our CD collection is also on Rhapsody. And she makes these theme playlists. She has like 90 that have anywhere from 30 to 200 tracks on these playlists, and they're just a joy to listen to. You start it in my other work, my circuit board design, I can just sit there and have this, you know, she was the DJ. Fabulous stuff. Jules Bomb, if you're in Rhapsody, that's her name on there. And it's just excellent. So I love Rhapsody. $15 a month, it's a bargain. That's a good point.
Rhapsody, I think, is great. I think there's a future for it. I don't know that it's entirely there yet. I think the primarily place for that is you've got to be sitting at your computer to use it, which not everybody's doing. I had a band play the grand opening in Vegas for Rhapsody at their launch, and in front of 100,000 people. I asked the guys at Rhapsody, like, God, this is great. You know, they're showing it to me before it launched, and it'd be great if you could have it on a portable device. The issue was the speeds of the phone, cell phones at the time, wasn't quite there. It's getting really close to where it can be, where you can carry around an iPhone or something like that and literally listen to whatever you want at any time. It's very, very close. It might even be
there.
Well, they have
it
bundled with Nokia. Well, okay. I mean, you can, if you have a device that is, you know, Rhapsody friendly, I guess, you can download stuff.
There's Rhapsody to go.
I think the other important issue with that is the only way that I think it could really work is if you can really get whatever you want on it, rather than having limited content. You know, if Universal doesn't do it or Warner doesn't do it, you're limited in what you can get.
And live things, too.
Yeah, live things as well, because I'm one that I love going to find rare live things. So if you can find, you know, artists post live recordings that they've got, if you can get whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted, on any kind of device, whether it's on your computer or a portable device, what's the use of having an iPod if you can just have that streaming on?
I think
so. For the legal guys, what's the chance of that kind of licensing happening?
Very good.
They come and go. It's strange. Things were on a playlist are now gone, and then they'll come back again, and they'll be gone because of licensing snafus.
Sure, I mean, but everybody's still working things out.
Yeah, we're talking about a universally available library, right?
The Celestial Jukebox.
Under one roof, you know, I mean, what's the chance that Rhapsody's going to be able to capture, you know, enough of what Wayne's talking about?
Well, they're not capturing Napster. That's the deal.
I think it can be sort of a chicken and an egg thing. You know, iTunes cemented itself as like the first really legitimate sort of online pay for your music thing. So, you know, a lot of labels didn't want to be the one that's not on iTunes. But at the same time, Rhapsody may not become as popular if you don't get all the labels. But if it becomes really popular, no label's going to be the one who doesn't want to be the one on Rhapsody.
That's your favorite.
No. But if it becomes more and more popular, you know, if there's holdouts, they probably won't be holdouts much longer the more popular it becomes.
And from the artist side, TuneCore is available now that anybody can get their music onto these systems. So any bands just pay $1 per store and $20 per album per year, and you get 100% of the income from the digital stores as an artist. That's TuneCore.
100% of which?
100% of whatever iTunes pays or Rhapsody pays or whatever.
Whatever iTunes pays.
The artist royalty.
That's no fee. It's 100%.
Except for the $20.
Except for the flat
maintenance.
Fee.
Yeah.
It's an interesting concept because other companies do it differently. They'll take a percentage of
CD
what
Baby's
you sell.
CD Baby's 9%, for instance.
Right. So what that says to me is they think, and they might be, making more money off artists by taking that $20 a year.
It's the gamble. Because that's no gamble. If you get $20
right, if you get $20, you got $20.
Per album.
That's
right.
The artist's problem to sell it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And promote it, and that's where it should be, really.
Yeah,
if what they're doing is automated, then why not just try to get the money in volume instead of a percentage? Yeah. You know, because if it costs them nothing to put one more on all these
exactly. It's incremental
systems.
Costs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what we're looking at right here is like what the consumer wants is a one-stop shop, all your music all the time and whenever you want it, like Wayne was mentioning. If you have if the iPods were hooked into a Grace Note database or something, a CDDB or something like that, where it had access to every album, then I think we would stop seeing people downloading and piracy, and then the intellectual properties and copyright RIA would be off everyone's butt. You know, we wouldn't see as much need to download and steal music because you have access to it. Then the consumer would
affordable.
Pay
for it.
Would pay for it.
And even if it costs money, it's still some people might want to do it rather than download.
Yeah,
because if it's instant, if it's accessible wherever you are,
your choices,
even if you're paying for it, I'd rather do that than go home, get on torrent or whatever. And
it's a hippie idea, you know, to think that this could ever work. But it's something that if it was possible to make it work, it would work. You know, it would be why we all pay for our internet service. Unless you have Wi-Fi and you're trying to jump off your neighbors. we do it all the time.
Google is actually trying to do.
Yeah. Trying to be the one stop for all information,
the
basically.
Video library when they bought YouTube. They just said, all the video content in the world, whether we own it or not, you can search Google and play. And they're going to be HD. They're going to do licensing deals. They're going to fight the copyrights. They're going to make deals to get them out of court. You know, they pay 5 cents on the dollar in advance rather than getting sued. And they're going to have this. And to think that they're not going to do this with music is a mistake.
So when it happens, you'll be happy, and I think we'll pay for it. I will. I'll pay my 15. I'll put it down first thing. If it started Monday, I put it down on Monday morning.
Now, how it gets split out then becomes the next question.
Yeah, that's the big challenge.
The big pool of money for the blanket licenses. Often the people that are pushing that are the people that want to administer the big pool of money for a percentage of the big pool of money.
Right.
You know, and that's sort of challenging.
Another thing that could hamper is if you're really getting everyone together, all these different labels together, to come to some agreement with some central
music
authority, you know, there could be an antitrust problem.
Yeah.
Good.
So.
Yeah, there has been.
And it's so well handled with Clear Channel. So well handled the antitrust situation. They mind all the theaters, all the bands, all the ticketings, and all the record contracts.
This next topic is one that I like to call 10:29 p.m. where we thank the panel. and say that, well, we always go long. We're long again, so here we are. Really appreciate all of the questions that we got. I thought we only got through about one-fifth of the topics that we kind of expected that. So anyway, thank you. Thank everybody for coming out.
Thanks for having us.